E-double-R-I-G-I-N-E-S. These people were, in other words, he writes, vagabonds of no fixed abode. The idea that any serious ancient scholars could turn a blind eye to the obviously correct etymology that was staring them in the face in favour of a silly idea that derived aborigines from to wander via a tendentious alternative spelling is not a reflection of their obtuseness. It shows just how ingrained the idea was that Rome had always been an ethnically fluid concept, that the Romans had always been on the move. Digging up early Rome. The many stories of Romulus and the other founders tell us a good deal about how the Romans saw their city, their values and their failings. They show too how Roman scholars debated the past and studied their history, but they tell us nothing, or at most very little indeed, about what they claim to, that is, what earliest Rome was like, the process by which it became an urban community, and when. One fact is obvious. Rome was already a very old city when Cicero was consul in 63 BCE. But if there is no surviving literature from the founding period and we cannot rely on the legends, how can we access any information about the origins of Rome? Is there any way of throwing light on the early years of the little town by the Tiber that grew into a world empire? However hard we try, it is impossible to construct a coherent narrative that could replace the legends of Romulus or Aeneas. It is also very hard, despite many confident assertions to the contrary, to pin precise dates onto the earliest phases of Roman history. But we can begin to get a much better idea of the general context in which the city developed and enjoy a few surprisingly vivid, and some even more tantalisingly elusive, glimpses into that world. One way of doing this is by turning away from the foundation stories and seeking out clues lurking in the Latin language or in later Roman institutions that might point back to earliest Rome. The key here is what is often simply and wrongly termed the conservatism of Roman culture. Rome was no more conservative than 19th century Britain. In both places, radical innovation thrived in dialogue with all kinds of ostensibly conservative traditions and rhetoric. Yet Roman culture was marked by a reluctance ever entirely to discard its past practices, tending instead to preserve all kinds of fossils in religious ritual or politics or whatever, even when their original significance had been lost. As one modern writer has nicely put it, the Romans were rather like people who acquire all kinds of brand new kitchen equipment, but can't ever bear to throw away their old gadgets, which continue to clutter up the place, even though they are never used. Scholars, both modern and ancient, have often suspected that some of these fossils, or old gadgets, may be important evidence for the conditions of earliest Rome. One favourite example is a ritual that took place in the city in December each year, known as the Septimontium, Seven Hills. What happened at this celebration is not at all clear, but one learned Roman noted that Septimontium was the name of Rome before it became Rome, and another gave a list of the hills, montes, involved in the festival. Palatium Velia Fagutal, Subura, Curmulus, Oppius, Caelius and Cispius. The fact that there are eight names suggests that something has got confused somewhere along the line. But more to the point, the oddity of this list. Palatium and Curmulus are both parts of the hill generally known as the Palatine, combined with the idea that Septimontium was the predecessor of Rome, has raised the possibility that these names might reflect the sites of separate villages that preceded the fully-fledged town. And the absence of a couple of obvious hills from the list, Quirinal and Viminal, has tempted some historians to go even further. Roman writers regularly referred to both of these hills as colles, rather than the more usual Latin montes. The meaning of the two words is more or less identical. Does that distinction point to two separate linguistic communities somewhere in Rome's early history? Could we possibly be dealing, to press the argument even further, with some version of the two groups reflected in the story of Romulus, the Sabines, associated with the Coles, the Romans with the Montes? Just possibly we could. There is little doubt that the Septimontium is related in some way to Rome's distant past, but in exactly what way and quite how distant is very hard to know. The arguments are no firmer than I have made them seem, probably even less so. Why, after all, should we trust that learned Roman's claim that Septimontium was the early name of the city? It was just as likely a desperate guess to explain an archaic ceremony that baffled him almost as much as it does us. And the insistence on two communities seems suspiciously driven by a desire to rescue at least some part of the legend of Romulus for history. More tangible is the evidence of archaeology. Dig down deep in the city of Rome, below the visible ancient monuments, and a few traces of a much earlier primitive settlement or settlements remain. Beneath the forum itself lie the remains of an early cemetery, which caused tremendous excitement when they were first unearthed at the start of the 20th century. Some of the dead had been cremated, their ashes placed in simple urns alongside jugs and vases which originally contained food and drink. One man had been given little quantities of fish, mutton and pork, and possibly some porridge. Others were buried, sometimes in simple oak coffins made by splitting a trunk and hollowing it out. One girl, about 2 years old, had been put in her grave wearing a beaded dress and an ivory bracelet. Similar finds have been made in other places all over the ancient city. Far below one of the later grand houses on the Palatine Hill, for example, lay the ashes of a young man interred with a miniature spear, maybe a symbol of how he had spent his life. The dead and buried are often much more prominent than the living in the archaeological record, but cemeteries imply the existence of a community, and traces of that are presumably to be found in the groups of huts whose faint outlines have been detected under various parts of the later city, including on the Palatine. We have little idea of their character, beyond their construction in wood, clay and thatch, still less of the lifestyle they supported. But we can fill in some of the gaps if we look just outside Rome. One of the best preserved and most carefully excavated of these early structures was found at Fidenae, a few miles north of the city, in the 1980s. It is a rectangular building, some 6 by 5 metres, made of wood, oak and elm, and rammed earth. So-called pisé de terre construction, still in use to the present day, with a rough-and-ready portico around it, formed by the overhanging roof. Inside was a central hearth, some large pottery storage jars, plus a smaller one which seems to have been a container for potting clay, and traces of some fairly predictable foodstuffs, cereals and beans, and domestic animals, sheep, goats, cows and pigs. The most surprising discovery amid the debris was the remains of a cat, which died, perhaps it was tethered, in a savage fire that eventually destroyed the building. Its claim to fame now is as the earliest known domestic cat in Italy. There are vivid glimpses of human and other life here, from the little girl laid out in her grave in her best dress to the poor mouser, whom no one let off his leash when the fire blazed. The question is, what those glimpses add up to? The archaeological remains certainly demonstrate that there is a long and rich prehistory behind the ancient Rome we see, but quite how long is another matter. Part of the problem is the conditions of excavation in the city itself. The site of Rome has been so intensively built on for centuries that we find these traces of early occupation only in spots that happen not to have been disturbed. The foundations dug in the 1st and 2nd centuries CE for the vast marble temples in the Forum obliterated much of what then lay beneath the surface. The cellars of the Renaissance Palazzi cut through even more in other parts of Rome. So we have only tiny snapshots, never the big picture. This is archaeology at its most difficult, and, although new fragments of evidence emerge all the time, its interpretation and reinterpretation is almost always contested and often controversial. For example, there is an ongoing debate about whether the small pieces of wattle and daub found in the excavations in the Forum in the mid-20th century indicate that there was an early hut settlement there too, or whether they were inadvertently introduced as part of the rubble used a few centuries later to provide a new raised surface for the area. It has to be said that, though fine for a cemetery, this would have been rather a damp and marshy place for a village. Precise dating is even more contentious. Hence my intentionally vague use of the word early over the last few pages. It cannot be stressed enough that there is no certain independent date for any of the archaeological material from earliest Rome or the area round about, and that arguments still rage about the age of almost every major find. It has taken decades of work over the past century or so, using such diagnostics as wheel-made pottery, assumed to be later than handmade, the occasional presence in graves of Greek ceramics, whose dating is better but still not perfectly understood, and careful comparison from site to site, to produce a rough chronological scheme covering the period from around 1000 to 600 BCE. On that basis, the earliest burials in the Forum would be around 1000 BCE, the huts on the Palatine around 750 to 700 BCE, excitingly close to 753 BCE, as many have observed, but even these dates are far from certain. Recent scientific methods, including radiocarbon dating, which calculates the age of any organic material by measuring the residual amount of its radioactive carbon isotope, have suggested that they are all too young, by as much as 100 years. The hut at Fidenae, for example, was dated around the middle of the 8th century BCE, according to traditional archaeological criteria. But that is pushed back towards the end of the 9th century BCE if we follow the radiocarbon. Currently dates are in flux, even more than usual. If anything, Rome appears to be getting older. What is certain is that by the 6th century BCE, Rome was an urban community with a centre and some public buildings. Before that, for the earliest phases, we have enough scattered finds from what is known as the Middle Bronze Age, between about 1700 and 1300 BCE, to suggest that some people were then living on the site, rather than just passing through. Over the period in between, we can be fairly confident that larger villages grew up, probably, to judge from what ends up in the graves, with an increasingly wealthy group of elite families, and that at some point these coalesced into the single community whose urban character was clear by the 6th century BCE. We cannot know for sure when the inhabitants of those separate settlements first thought of themselves as a single town, and we have absolutely no idea when they first thought of and referred to that town as Rome. Archaeology is not, however, just about dates and origins. The material dug up in the city, the area around it, and even further afield, has important things to tell us about the character of Rome's early settlement. First, it had extensive contacts with the outside world. I've already mentioned in passing the ivory bracelet of the little girl in the cemetery and the Greek pottery, made in Corinth or Athens, that turns up in Roman excavations. There are also signs of links with the north in the form of a few jewels and decorations in imported amber. There is no clue of how these reached central Italy, but they certainly point to contact, direct or indirect, with the Baltic. Early Rome, from almost as far back as we can see it, was well connected, as Cicero hinted when he stressed its strategic location. Second, there were similarities and some important differences between Rome and its neighbours. The Italian peninsula between about 1000 and 600 BC was extremely mixed. There were many different independent peoples with many different cultural traditions, origins, and languages. The best documented are the Greek settlements in the south, towns such as Cumae, Tarentum, and Naples, Neapolis, founded from the 8th century BCE on by immigrants from some of the major cities in Greece, conventionally known as colonies, but not colonial in the modern sense of the word. To all intents and purposes, much of the southern part of the peninsula and Sicily was part of the Greek world, with a literate and artistic tradition linked to match. It is no coincidence that some of the earliest specimens of Greek writing to survive, maybe the very earliest, have actually been discovered there. It is much harder to reconstruct the history of any of the other inhabitants of the peninsula. From the Etruscans to the north, through the Latins and Sabines on Rome's doorstep to the south, to the Oscans, who formed the original population of Pompeii, and Samnites beyond them. None of their literature, if they had any, has survived, and for evidence of them we depend entirely on archaeology, on texts inscribed on stone and bronze, sometimes comprehensible, sometimes not, and on Roman accounts written much later, often tinged with Roman supremacy. Hence the standard image of the Samnites as tough, barbaric, non-urbanized, and dangerously primitive. What archaeological finds do show, however, is that Rome in its early days was very ordinary indeed. The development from scattered settlements into an urban community that we can just about detect in Rome seems to have happened at roughly the same period throughout the neighbouring region to its south. And the material remains in the cemeteries. Local pottery and bronze brooches, as well as more exotic imports, are fairly consistent there too. If anything, what has been discovered in Rome is less impressive and less suggestive of wealth than discoveries elsewhere. Nothing has emerged from the city to compare with, for example, the finds from some extraordinary tombs in nearby Praeneste, though that might just be bad luck, or, as some archaeologists have suspected, a case of some of the best finds from the 19th century excavations in Rome having been stolen and directed straight to the antiquities market. One of the questions we shall have to address over the next couple of chapters is, when did Rome cease to be ordinary? The missing link. The final question for this chapter, however, is whether the archaeological material must remain quite as separate from the mythical traditions of Romulus and Remus as I have presented it. Is it possible to link our investigations into the earliest history of Rome with the stories that the Romans themselves told, or with their elaborate speculations on the city's origins? Can we perhaps find a little more history in the myth? This is a seductive temptation that has influenced a lot of modern work on early Rome by both historians and archaeologists. We have already spotted the attempt to make the story of the Septimontium reflect the dual nature of the city, Roman and Sabine, which the myth of Romulus emphasizes. Recently, the discovery of some early earthwork defences at the foot of the Palatine Hill has prompted all kinds of wild speculation that these were the very defences over which Remus jumped to meet his death on the city's foundation day. This is archaeological fantasy. There is no doubt that some early earthworks have been discovered, and that in itself is important, though how they relate to the early hut settlement on the top of the Palatine is puzzling. They are nothing whatsoever to do with the non-existent characters Romulus and Remus, and the attempts to massage the dating of the structure and its associated finds to end up on the 21st of April 753 BCE, I am exaggerating only slightly, are special pleading. There is just one location in the whole of the city of Rome where it is possible to link the early material remains directly with the literary tradition. In doing so, we find not agreement and harmony between the two, but a wide and intriguing gap. That location is at one end of the Forum, close to the slopes of the Capitoline Hill, a few minutes' walk from where Cicero attacked Catiline in the temple of Jupiter Stator, and just next to the main platform, or rostra, from which speakers addressed the people. There, before the end of the 1st century BCE, in the pavement of the Forum, was set a series of slabs in distinctively black stone, forming a rectangle of roughly 4 by 3.5 metres, marked out with a low stone border. At the turn of the 19th and 20th centuries, the archaeologist Giacomo Buoni, a celebrity at the time to rival Heinrich Schliemann, the discoverer of Troy, and with none of the dubious reputation for fraud, excavated below the black stone, where he found the remains of some much earlier structures. These included an altar, part of a large freestanding column, and a short stone pillar that is covered in mostly unintelligible early Latin, probably one of the earliest texts in the language that we have. The place had been intentionally buried, and the fill included all kinds of extraordinary as well as everyday finds, from miniature cups, beads and knuckle bones, to some fine pieces of 6th century BCE Athenian decorated pottery. The most obvious explanation, to judge from the finds, which seem to include religious dedications, is that this was an early shrine, possibly of the god Vulcan. It was covered over when the Forum was repaved sometime in the 1st century BCE, but to preserve the memory of the sacred site underneath, the distinctive black stone was laid above. Later Roman writers were well aware of the black stone and had various ideas about what it signified. The black stone, one wrote, marks an unlucky spot, and they knew that there was something underneath it, going back centuries. Not a religious shrine, as archaeologists are now fairly confident it was, but a monument connected with Romulus or his family. Several assumed it was the tomb of Romulus. Others, perhaps worried that if Romulus had become a god, he should not really have a tomb, thought it was the tomb of Faustulus, the foster-father of Romulus and Remus. Still others made it the tomb of one of Romulus's comrades, Hostilius, the grandfather of one of the later kings of Rome. They also knew, whether because they had seen it before it was covered, or from hearsay, that there was an inscription down there. Dionysius records two versions of what it was: the epitaph of Hostilius, documenting his bravery, or an inscription, recording his deeds, put up after one of Romulus's victories. But it was certainly neither of those things. Nor was it, as Dionysius claims, written in Greek letters. It is bona fide early Latin, but it makes a marvellous example of both how much and how little Roman historians knew about the buried past, and how they so liked to imagine the traces of Romulus still present on or just below the surface of their city. What this text actually says, so far as we can make any sense of it, takes us into the next phase of Roman history and the series of almost equally mythical kings who were supposed to have followed Romulus. Chapter 3. The Kings of Rome. Written on the Stone. The inscription discovered in 1899 under the black stone in the Forum includes the word king, or in Latin, rex. R-E-C-E-I, as it appears in the early form of the language used there. That single word accounts for the inscription's fame and has changed the way the history of early Rome has been understood ever since. The text is in many respects extremely frustrating. It is incomplete, the top third of the pillar not surviving. It is close to incomprehensible. The Latin is difficult enough anyway, but the missing section makes it almost impossible to grasp the meaning fully. Even though we can be certain that it does not mark the tomb of Romulus, or of anyone else, most interpretations amount to little more than brave attempts to string together into some vague sense the few individual words that are recognisable on the stone. One notable modern theory is that it was a warning not to let yoked animals drop excrement near the shrine, which would apparently have been a bad omen. It is also very hard to know how old it is. The only way to date the text is by comparing its language and script to the handful of other surviving examples of early Latin, for the most part equally uncertainly dated. Suggestions have ranged over 300 years, from around 700 to around 400 BCE. The current fragile consensus is that it was inscribed in the second half of the 6th century BCE. Despite all those unknowns, archaeologists instantly realised that the recognisable R-E-C-E-I in the dative case, meaning to or for the king, supports what Roman writers themselves had claimed, that for 2.5 centuries, up to the end of the 6th century BCE, the city of Rome had been under the control of kings. Livy, among others, tells of a standard sequence of 6 monarchs following Romulus, each with a distinctive package of achievements attached to his name. Their colourful stories, with a supporting cast of heroic Roman warriors, murderous rivals and scheming queens, take up the second half of the first book of Livy's history. After Romulus came Numa Pompilius, a peaceable character who invented most of the religious institutions of Rome. Then Tullus Hostilius, a renowned warmonger. After him, Ancus Marcius, the founder of Rome's seaport at Ostia, river mouth. Then Tarquinius Priscus, or Tarquin the Elder, who developed the Roman Forum and the great circus games. Then Servius Tullius, a political reformer and the inventor of the Roman census. And finally, Tarquinius Superbus, Tarquin the Proud, or, perhaps better, the Arrogant. It was the tyrannical behaviour of this second Tarquin and of his family that led to revolution, to the end of the monarchy and to the establishing of liberty and the free Republic of Rome. He was a paranoid autocrat who ruthlessly eliminated his rivals and a cruel exploiter of the Roman people, forcing them to labour on his fanatical building projects. But the awful breaking point came, as such breaking points did more than once in Roman history, with a rape. This time, the rape of the virtuous Lucretia by one of the king's sons. Cautious scholars in the 19th century had been extremely doubtful about the historical value of these stories of the Roman kings. They argued that there was hardly any more firm evidence for these rulers than for the legendary Romulus. The whole tradition was based on garbled hearsay and misunderstood myth, not to mention the propagandist fantasies of many of the later leading families at Rome, who regularly manipulated or invented the history of the early city to give their ancestors a glorious role in it. It was only a short step from this, and a step that many notable historians then took, to claim that the Roman regal period, as it is now often called, never existed, that those famous kings were figments of the Roman imagination, that the true history of early Rome was entirely lost to us. R-E-C-E-I in Borny's inscription successfully challenged that radical scepticism. No amount of special pleading, that, for example, Rex here refers to a later religious official of the same name but not a king in the technical sense, could get round what now seemed undeniable, that Rome had once been some kind of monarchy. The discovery changed the nature of the debate on early Roman history, though, of course, it prompted other questions. Even now, this inscription puts the idea of the Roman kings centre stage, and raises the question of what kingship might mean in the context of a small, archaic community of a few thousand inhabitants living in wattle and daub huts on a group of hilltops near the River Tiber. The word king almost certainly implies something much more formal and grander than we should be envisaging. But there were many different ways in which later Romans saw or imagined their early rulers. On the one hand, after the dramatic fall of Tarquinius Superbus, kings were an object of hatred for the rest of Roman history. To be accused of wanting to be rex was a political death sentence for any Roman. And no Roman emperor would ever countenance being called a king, even though some cynical observers wondered what the difference was. On the other hand, Roman writers traced many of their most significant political and religious institutions back to the regal period. If, in the legendary narrative, the city was conceived under Romulus, its gestation came under the kings from Numa to the second Tarquin. Abominated as they were, kings were credited with creating Rome. This regal period is caught in that intriguing territory that straddles the boundary dividing myth from history. These successor kings certainly appear more real than the founder. If nothing else, they have apparently real names, such as Numa Pompilius, unlike the fictional Romulus or Mr. Rome. Yet throughout their stories we meet all kinds of flagrantly mythical elements. Some said that Servius Tullius, just like Romulus, was conceived from a phallus that emerged from fire. It is almost always hard to identify what facts might be lurking in the fictional narrative that has come down to us. Merely to strip away the obviously fantastical elements and to assume that what is left represents an historical core is exactly the kind of simplistic approach that the 19th century sceptics rightly resisted. Myth and history prove much more inextricably bound together than that. A full spectrum of possibilities and unknowables exists between the two extremes. Did someone called Ancus Marcius once exist, but not do any of the things attributed to him? Were those things the work of some person or persons other than Ancus, but of unknown name, and so on? It is clear, however, that towards the end of the regal period, let's say the 6th century BCE, though precision dating remains as hard as ever, we begin to reach slightly firmer ground. As Boni's dramatic discoveries hint, it then becomes plausible, for the first time, to make some links between the stories that the Romans told about their past, the archaeological traces in the ground, and a historical narrative, in our sense of the term. What is more, we even get a glimpse of some of this history from the point of view of Rome's neighbours and enemies. Exploits of Servius Tullius almost certainly feature in a series of paintings discovered in a tomb in the Etruscan city of Vulci, 70 miles to the north of Rome. Dating from around the mid-4th century BCE, they are by several hundred years the earliest direct evidence for him that we have anywhere. Understanding the history of Rome at this period partly depends on exploiting for all their worth the few such precious pieces of evidence we have. And we shall shortly be taking a closer look at this one. Kings or chiefs? The 19th century sceptics had good reason to doubt the surviving Roman accounts of the regal period. There are all kinds of things about the kings that do not quite add up, most obviously their chronology. Even if we imagine unusually healthy lifespans, it is impossible to make 7 kings, Romulus included, spread over the 250 years, from the mid-8th century to the late 6th century BCE, that Roman writers assign to them. That would mean each of them reigned, on average, for more than 3 decades. No modern monarchy has ever equaled that consistent level of longevity. The most economical solution to this problem is either to assume that the regal period was really much shorter than the Romans calculated, or to propose that there were more kings than have come down in the record. There are, as we shall discover, a couple of potential candidates for these lost monarchs. But it is also possible that the written tradition we have for this period is more fundamentally misleading than these simple solutions suggest, and that, whatever the chronology, the character of Roman kingship was, in reality, radically different from what Livy and other Roman writers imply. The biggest problem is that Rome's ancient historians tended systematically to modernize the regal period and to aggrandize its achievements, as if seeing them through some patriotic magnifying glass. According to their accounts, the early Romans already relied on such institutions as the Senate and the assemblies of the people, which were part of the political institutional furniture of the city, half a millennium later. And in arranging the kingly succession, which was not hereditary, they followed complex legal procedures that involved the appointment of an interrex, a between king, a popular vote for the new monarch and senatorial ratification. What is more, the power struggles and rivalries they imagine at these moments of transition would not have looked out of place in the court of the Roman emperor in the 1st century CE. In fact, Livy's account of the wheeling and dealing after the murder of Tarquinius Priscus, in which his scheming wife, Tanaquil, carefully conceals the death until she has firmly secured the throne for her favourite, Servius Tullius, is similar to the wheeling and dealing by Livia after the death of the Emperor Augustus in 14 CE. It is so similar that some critics have suspected that Livy, who was writing from the 20s BCE, could not possibly have completed this section of his history until after 14 CE and must have based his description on the events of that year. Roman relations with neighbouring peoples are described on a similarly grand scale, complete with treaties, ambassadors, and formal declarations of war. Their fighting, too, is presented as if it involved large-scale clashes between mighty Roman legions and equally mighty enemies. We read of the cavalry charging the opposing flanks, of the infantry being forced to yield, of the opposition driven to confusion, and various other clichés or truths of ancient battle. Indeed, this kind of language seeps into modern accounts of the period, many of which also confidently refer to such things as the foreign policy of Rome in the 7th and 6th centuries BCE. At this point, a reality check is required. However else we may choose to describe the urban community of the early Romans, it remains somewhere on the spectrum between tiny and small. Population size in what is effectively prehistory is notoriously difficult to estimate, but the best guess is that the original population of Rome, at whatever moment it was when the aggregate of little settlements started thinking of itself as Rome, amounted to, at most, a few thousand. By the time the last king was thrown out, towards the end of the 6th century BCE, according to the standard modern calculations, we are probably dealing with something in the region of 20,000 to 30,000 inhabitants. This is only a best guess based on the size of the place, the amount of territory that Rome probably controlled at that point, and what population we could reasonably expect it to support. But it is much more likely than the exaggerated totals that ancient authors give. Livy, for example, quotes the very first Roman historian, Quintus Fabius Pictor, who wrote around 200 BCE, and claimed that towards the end of the regal period, the number of adult male citizens was 80,000, making a total population of well over 200,000. This is a ludicrous figure for a new community in archaic Italy. It is not far short of the total population of the territories of Athens or Sparta at their height in the mid-5th century BCE, and there is no archaeological evidence for a city of any such size at this time, although the number does at least have the virtue of matching the aggrandizing views of early Rome found in all ancient writers. It is, needless to say, impossible to know anything much about the institutions of this small proto-urban settlement. But unless Rome was different from every other archaic township in the ancient Mediterranean, or early townships anywhere, it would have been much less formally structured than the stories suggest. Complex procedures involving an interrex, popular voting, and senatorial ratification are entirely implausible in this context. At best, they are a radical rewriting of early history in a much later idiom. Military activity is another good case in point. Here, geography alone should give us pause. We need simply look at the location of these heroic battles. They were all fought within a radius of about 12 miles of the city of Rome. Despite the style in which they are recounted, as if they were mini versions of Rome against Hannibal, they were probably something closer, in our terms, to cattle raids. They may not even have been Roman engagements in the strict sense of the word at all. In most early communities, it took a long time before the various forms of private violence, from rough justice and vendetta to guerrilla warfare, came fully under public control. Conflict of all sorts was regularly in the hands of individuals with their own following, the ancient equivalents of what we might call private warlords, and there was a blurry distinction between what was conducted on behalf of the state and what on behalf of some powerful leader. Almost certainly that was the case in early Rome. So where does that leave the kings and the word rex on the inscription from the Forum? Rex can certainly mean king in the modern sense, a sense we broadly share with the Romans of the first century BCE. They, like us, would have had in mind not just an image of autocratic power and its symbols, but also a theoretical concept of monarchy as a form of government, to be contrasted with, for example, democracy or oligarchy. It is extremely unlikely that anything of this sort was in the minds of the men who, centuries earlier, carved the stone in the Forum. For them, rex would have signalled individual power and prominence, but in a much less structured, constitutional way. When we are discussing the realities rather than the myths of this early period of Roman history, it might be better to think in terms of chiefs or big men instead of kings, and to think of the chiefly rather than the regal period. Foundation stories, religion, time, and politics. For Roman writers, the kings who followed Romulus were part of the extended foundation process of the city of Rome. Like him, these rulers were assumed to be historical characters, even if more sceptical writers doubted some of the taller stories told about them. But again, it is clear that much of the tradition that has come down to us, far from reality, is a fascinating mythical projection of later Roman priorities and anxieties into the distant past. It is not hard to spot many of the same themes and concerns that we found in the story of Romulus. These successor kings, for example, were said to come from all kinds of different backgrounds. Numa, like Titus Tatius, was a Sabine. Tarquinius Priscus came from Etruria and was the son of a refugee from the Greek city of Corinth. Servius Tullius was, according to those who rejected the story of the miraculous phallus, the son of a slave, or at least of a prisoner of war. Such was the dispute over his parentage, that of all the triumphing generals listed on the roster in the Forum, Servius is the only one whose father's name is omitted. Although we read of occasional Romans, usually the bad ones in these stories, complaining that foreigners or the low-born are taking away their birthright, the overall message is unmistakable. Even at the very pinnacle of the Roman political order, Romans could come from elsewhere, and those low-born, even ex-slaves, could rise to the top. Rome under the kings also continued to be torn apart by bitter civil war and family conflicts. Moments of succession proved particularly dangerous and bloody. Of the seven kings, it was alleged that three were murdered. A divine lightning bolt struck another as punishment for a religious error, and Tarquinius Superbus was expelled. Only two died in their beds. It was the sons of Ancus Marcius, in resentment at being passed over for the throne, who hired the assassins of Tarquinius Priscus. Servius Tullius was murdered for similar reasons by Superbus, who was in league with his victim's own daughter. In a particularly gruesome twist, the daughter is supposed to have deliberately driven over the dead body with her carriage and brought her father's blood into her house on its wheels. This theme certainly picks up the idea that civil conflict was embedded in Roman politics. But it also points to another fault line in Roman political culture. That is, how power was transmitted from person to person or generation to generation. It is worth noting that more than half a millennium later, the first dynasty of new autocrats, the emperors from Augustus to Nero, had a similar, or even worse, record of brutal death, largely murder, or alleged murder, from within the family. The regal period, however, did more than simply replay the issues that Romulus raised. To follow the logic of the story, by the end of Romulus's rule, Rome was still only half-formed. Each of the successors made his own distinctive contribution, so ensuring that when the monarchy eventually fell, Rome was equipped with most of the characteristic institutions that made it Roman. Numa Pompilius and Servius Tullius were given the credit for the most significant of these. Servius Tullius is supposed to have devised the method of counting and rank ordering the Roman people known as the census. This lay at the heart of ancient Rome's political process for centuries, enshrining in it a fundamental hierarchical principle that the rich had, by right, more power than the poor. But before him, Numa is said to have established, more or less single-handedly, the structure of official Roman religion and religious institutions that left their mark and their names well beyond the limits of this book. In fact, the official title of the Catholic popes even now, Pontifex, or Pontiff, derives, or was borrowed, from the title of one of the priesthoods supposedly founded by Numa. Looking back over their city's rise to dominance in the Mediterranean and beyond, later Romans attributed their extraordinary success not merely to military prowess. They had triumphed, they reasoned, because they had the gods on their side. Their pious devotion to religion guaranteed their success. And, to reverse the axiom, any failure they encountered could be put down to some fault in their dealings with the gods. Perhaps they had ignored bad omens, wrongly conducted a key ritual, or run roughshod over religious rules. Their piety became a boast in their dealings with the outside world. At the beginning of the 2nd century BCE, for example, when one Roman official wrote to the Greek town of Teos on the western coast of modern Turkey, guaranteeing the Teans' political independence, in the short term at least, he rammed the message home. We can still see his somewhat pompous words inscribed on a block of marble that was displayed in the town. The fact that we Romans have, absolutely and consistently, judged reverence towards the gods as of first importance is proved by the favour we have received from them on this account. In addition, we are quite certain, for many other reasons, that our high respect for the divine has been evident to everybody. Religion, in other words, underwrote Roman power. There are a few glimpses of this in the story of Romulus. As well as dedicating the temple of Jupiter Stator, he consulted the gods in deciding where exactly to found the new city. It was partly a disagreement about how to interpret the divine signs observed in the flight of some birds that led to the fatal quarrel between Romulus and Remus, but it was his successor, the peace-loving Numa, who was given the role of the founder of Roman religion. This did not make Numa a holy figure along the lines of Moses, the Buddha, Jesus, or Muhammad. The traditional religion of Rome was significantly different from religion as we usually understand it now. So much modern religious vocabulary, including the word religion, as well as pontiff, is borrowed from Latin that it tends to obscure some of the major differences between ancient Roman religion and our own. In Rome there was no doctrine as such, no holy book, and hardly even what we would call a belief system. Romans knew the gods existed. They did not believe in them, in the internalized sense familiar from most modern world religions. Nor was ancient Roman religion particularly concerned with personal salvation or morality. Instead, it mainly focused on the performance of rituals that were intended to keep the relationship between Rome and the gods in good order. and so ensure Roman success and prosperity. The sacrifice of animals was a central element in most of these rituals, which otherwise were extraordinarily varied. Some were so outlandish that they undermined better than anything else the modern stereotype of the Romans as stuffy and sedate. At the festival of Lupercalia in February, for example, naked young men ran round the city whipping any women they met. This is the festival that the opening scene of Shakespeare's Julius Caesar recreates. In general, it was a religion of doing, not believing. In line with this, Numa's foundation had two different but related aspects. On the one hand, he established a series of priesthoods to perform or oversee major rituals, including, among an otherwise overwhelmingly male lineup, the Vestal Virgins, with their duty to keep the flame alight on the city's sacred hearth in the Forum. On the other hand, he devised a calendar of 12 months, which provided the framework for the annual roster of festivals, holy days and holidays. A crucial aspect of any organized community is its ability to structure time, and in Rome it was Numa who was given the credit for inventing that structure. What is more, notwithstanding all kinds of later innovations and refinements, the modern Western calendar remains a direct descendant of this early Roman version. As the names we give our months show, every single one of them is Roman. Among all things we fancy we have inherited from ancient Rome, from drains to place names, or the offices of the Catholic Church, the calendar is probably the most important and the most often overlooked. It is a surprising link between that early regal period and our world. Whether or not anyone called Numa Pompilius ever existed is impossible to know, still less whether he did any of the things ascribed to him. Roman scholars discussed his career intensely, accepting some aspects of the tradition about him, but firmly rejecting others. He could not possibly, for example, have been the pupil of the Greek philosopher Pythagoras, as one popular and tenacious story went. For, they argued, on any plausible chronology, Pythagoras lived more than a century after Numa, or, as we now reckon, in the 6th rather than the 7th century BCE. But no matter how legendary or, at best, shadowy Numa was, one thing seems certain. Some form of the calendar ascribed to him is the product of an early period in Rome's history. In fact, the earliest written version of a Roman calendar that we have, although itself from no earlier than the 1st century BCE, points strongly in that direction. It is an extraordinary survival, found painted on a wall in the town of Antium, modern Anzio, some 35 miles south of Rome, and offers a vivid, if slightly perplexing, glimpse of how Romans of Cicero's time pictured their year. Nothing in early Rome would have been as complex as this. There are signs of all kinds of developments over the centuries, including some radical changes in the ordering of months and in the starting point of the year. For how else could November and December, meaning literally 9th month and 10th month respectively, have ended up in this calendar and our own as the 11th and 12th months in the sequence? But there are also hints of an ancient pedigree in this 1st century BCE version. Its system is basically one of 12 lunar months, with an extra month, the distant precursor of our extra day in a leap year, inserted from time to time to keep this calendar in proper alignment with the solar year. The biggest challenge facing primitive calendars everywhere is the fact that the two most obvious natural systems of timekeeping are incompatible. That is to say, 12 lunar months, from new moon to new moon, add up to just over 354 days. And this cannot be made to match in any convenient way to the 365 and a quarter days of the solar year, which is the time it takes for the Earth to make one complete circuit of the Sun, from spring equinox to spring equinox, for instance. The wholesale insertion of an extra month every few years is just the kind of rough-and-ready method typical of early attempts to solve the problem. No less revealing is the cycle of religious festivals that are recorded in the calendar. The nucleus of these may well have originated as far back as the regal period. Certainly the focus of many of them, so far as we can reconstruct it, is on the support of the gods for the seasonal concerns of animal husbandry and agriculture, sowing, harvesting, grape picking, storing, and so forth. Exactly the concerns that one would expect to weigh heavily in a small, archaic Mediterranean community. Whatever these festivals meant in the urban metropolis of the first century BCE, the majority of whose inhabitants would have had little to do with flocks, herds, or harvesting, they probably do represent a snapshot of the priorities of the earliest Romans. A different set of priorities is reflected in the political institutions attributed to Servius Tullius, sometimes now given the inappropriately grand title of the Servian Constitution, partly because they were so fundamental to the later working of Roman politics. He is supposed to have been the first to organise a census of the Roman citizens, formally enrolling them in the citizen body and classifying them in different ranks according to their wealth. But more than that, he linked this classification to two further institutions, the Roman army and the organisation of the people for voting and elections. The precise details are almost unfathomably complicated and have been debated since antiquity. Academic careers have been made and lost in the fruitless search for the exact arrangements supposedly put in place by Servius Tullius and their subsequent history. But the basic outlines are clear enough. The army was to be made up of 193 centuries, distinguished according to the type of equipment the soldiers used. This equipment was related to the census classification on the principle of the richer you are, the more substantial and expensive equipment you can provide for yourself. Starting at the top, there were 80 centuries of men from the richest first class who fought in a full kit of heavy bronze armour. Below these came four more classes, wearing progressively lighter armour down to the fifth class of 30 centuries, who fought with just slings and stones. In addition, above these, there were an extra 18 centuries of elite cavalry, plus some special groups of engineers and musicians, and at the very bottom of the pecking order, a single century of the very poorest, who were entirely exempt from military service. Servius Tullius is supposed to have used these same structures as the basis of one main voting assembly of the Roman people, the Centuriate Assembly, so called after the centuries, which in Cicero's day came together to elect senior officials, including the consuls, and to vote on laws and on decisions to go to war. Each century had just one block vote, and the consequence, or intention, was to hand to the centuries of the rich an overwhelming, built-in political advantage. If they stuck together, the 80 centuries of the richest first class plus the 18 centuries of elite cavalry could outvote all the other classes put together. To put it another way, the individual rich voter had far greater voting powers than his poorer fellow citizens. This was because, despite their name, which looks as if it should mean that they comprised 100 centum men each, the centuries were in fact very different in size. The richest citizens were far fewer in number than the poor, but they were divided among 80 centuries, as against the 20 or 30 for the more populous lower classes, or the single century for the mass of the very poorest. Power was vested in the wealthy, both communally and individually. In detail, this is not only terribly complicated, but also anachronistic. Whereas some of the innovations attributed to Numa might not have been out of place, as we have seen in early Rome, this is a flagrant projection into the past of much later Roman practices and institutions, complete with Servius Tullius as founding father. The complex system of property valuation entailed in the census is inconceivable in the early city, and the elaborate structures of the centuriate organisation in both army and assembly are totally out of scale with the citizen body of the regal period and with the likely character of its warfare. This isn't how you conduct a raid on the next-door village. Whatever changes in fighting or voting might have been instituted under some Servius Tullius, they could not have been anything like what Roman tradition claimed. Yet, by pushing all this back into the formative period of their city, Roman writers were underlining the importance of some key institutions and key connections in Roman political culture, as they saw it. In the census, they were highlighting the power of the state over the individual citizen, as well as that characteristic commitment of Roman officialdom to documenting, counting, and classifying. They were also pointing to a traditional connection between the political and military roles of the citizen, to the fact that for many centuries Roman citizens were also, by definition, Roman soldiers, and to one of the treasured assumptions of many of the Roman elite, namely that wealth brought both political responsibility and political privilege. Cicero reflects exactly that when he sums up Servius Tullius's political objectives in approving tones. He divided the people in this way to ensure that voting power was under the control not of the rabble, but of the wealthy, and he saw to it that the greatest number did not have the greatest power, a principle that we should always stand by in politics. In fact, this principle came to be vigorously contested in the politics of Rome. Etruscan kings? Servius Tullius was one of the last three kings of Rome, sandwiched between Tarquinius Priscus and Tarquinius Superbus. Roman scholars believed that they ruled over the city through the 6th century BCE until Superbus was finally deposed in, according to most accounts, 509 BCE. As we have just seen, parts of the narrative of this period were no less mythologized than the story of Romulus, and there are some chronological impossibilities, or at least the usual implausible longevities, in the traditional tale. Even some ancient writers were uncomfortable with the idea that there appeared to be roughly 150 years between the birth of Priscus and the death of his son Superbus, a problem they sometimes tried to resolve by suggesting that the second Tarquin was the grandson, not the son, of the first. Yet, from this date on, it does become easier to align some aspects of what we read in Livy and other writers with what has been found in the ground. So, for example, traces of a temple, or temples, that appear to go back to the 6th century BCE have been uncovered in more or less the place where later Roman scholars claimed that Servius Tullius established two major shrines. This is still a long way from being able to say, we have found the temples of Servius Tullius, whatever exactly that would mean, but there is at least increasing convergence in the different strands of evidence. For Romans, however, two things distinguished this group of kings from their predecessors. First was their particularly bloody story. Priscus was murdered by the sons of his predecessor. Servius Tullius was eased onto the throne in a palace coup, masterminded by Tanaquil, and was eventually murdered by Superbus. Second was their Etruscan connection. For the two Tarquins, this was a case of direct ancestry, Priscus is supposed to have migrated to Rome from the Etruscan town of Tarquinii, along with his Etruscan wife, Tanaquil, to seek his fortune because he feared, so the story went, that his foreign blood from his Greek father would hold back his career in his hometown. For Servius Tullius, it was more a case of being the favoured protégé of the Etruscan Priscus and Tanaquil. Cicero is unusual in insinuating, among all the other versions of this king's origins, that he was Priscus's illegitimate son. The question that has often puzzled modern historians is how to explain this Etruscan connection. Why are these kings of Rome given an Etruscan pedigree? Was there really a period when Etruscan kings controlled the city? So far we have focused on Rome's neighbours to the south, those that played a part in the foundation stories of Romulus and Aeneas, The Sabines, for example, or the little town of Alba Longa, founded by Aeneas's son, and the place where Romulus and Remus were born. But just to the north of Rome, stretching up into modern Tuscany, lay the heartlands of the Etruscans, the richest and most powerful people in Italy, over the period when the first urban community of Rome was taking shape. The plural, Etruscans, is important. For these people did not form a single state, but were a group of independent towns and cities which shared a language and distinctive artistic culture. The extent of their power varied over time, but at its widest, Etruscan settlements and recognisable Etruscan influence could be found as far south in Italy as Pompeii and beyond. Modern visitors to the archaeological sites of Etruria have often been entranced by the romance of the place, the eerie cemeteries of the Etruscan towns, with their lavishly painted tombs, have captured the imaginations of generations of writers, artists, and tourists, from D.H. Lawrence to the sculptor Alberto Giacometti. Indeed, Roman scholars of later periods, too, after the Etruscan cities had one by one fallen to Rome, could see Etruria both as an intriguingly exotic subject of study and the source of some of their own ceremonial dress and religious practices. But certainly, at the period of Rome's earliest history, these Etruscan places, to borrow Lawrence's title, were influential, rich, and well-connected in a way that far outstripped Rome. They had active trading links across the Mediterranean and beyond, as we can see in archaeological finds of amber, ivory, and even an ostrich egg on one site, as well as in all the finely decorated classical Athenian pots that have come from Etruscan tombs. Far more of these found in Etruria than in Greece itself. Underpinning this wealth and influence were natural mineral resources. There was so much bronze work in the Etruscan cities that even in 1546 enough was discovered at the site of Tarquinii alone to produce almost 3,000 kilos, once melted down, for decorating the church of St. John Lateran in Rome. On a smaller but no less significant scale, recent analysis has shown that a piece of iron ore discovered on the island of Pithecusae, Ischia, in the Bay of Naples, originally came from the Etruscan island of Elba. To fall back on a modernization, it was presumably part of their export trade. Rome's position at Etruria's back door helped its rise to wealth and prominence. But was there something more sinister about those Etruscan kings? One suspicious view is that the story of the Etruscan connection of the two Tarquins and Servius Tullius covers up an invasion and takeover of Rome by the Etruscans, probably on their way south as they expanded into Campania. That is to say, the patriotic tradition at Rome rewrote this ignominious period of Roman history as if it revolved not around conquest, but around the individual migration of Tarquinius Priscus and his subsequent rise to kingship. The uncomfortable truth was that Rome had become an Etruscan possession. This is a clever idea, but most unlikely. For a start, although there are clear traces of Etruscan art and other products in Rome, and a handful of inscriptions written in the Etruscan language, there is nothing in the archaeological record to suggest a major takeover. Close links between the two cultures, yes. Conquest, no. But perhaps more to the point, that model of state takeover is inappropriate for the kind of relations we should be envisaging between these neighbouring communities, or at least it is not the only model. As I have already suggested, this was a world of big men and warlords, powerful individuals who were relatively mobile between the various towns of the region, sometimes in a friendly form of mobility, sometimes presumably not. Alongside them there must have been equally mobile members of their militia bands, traders, travelling craftsmen, and migrants of any and every sort. Exactly who the Roman Fabius was, whose name is inscribed on his tomb in the Etruscan town of Caere, it is impossible